You are listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simpler Living Works with co-hosts Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. Today we feature a conversation between Lee and Jerry about Lee's newest book, The Liberating Birth of Jesus, a birth story able to reverse our planet's peril. Greetings, Lee, from Sioux City, Iowa, and Simple Living Works.
Greetings to you, Jerry, from San Diego, and Jubilee One Earth Economics.
Lee has served as co-founder and director of Jubilee One Earth Living for almost 20 years. He has written two parts of his trilogy, Eden for the 21st Century. Part one is Blinded by Progress, Breaking Out of the Illusion That Holds Us. Part two, From Egos to Eden, Our Heroic Journey to Keep Earth Livable. A couple of years ago, he wrote a series of blogs about Christmas. He has now expanded that into a little book that I have read and can highly recommend. So, Lee, tell us, what made you decide to write this book?
Well, and you had a big part in it, actually, and I say so in the acknowledgments or gratitude pages of this book. It's a small book, by the way, about 140 pages. And, you know, I wasn't inclined to turn those blogs into a book. It's a lot of work. And I just didn't have that thing in my gut that says, do it. Well, what changed? It changed for me really in this in the Christmas season of 2018, and I enjoyed myself. We had just a magical tree, and I think of that tree all ornamented as the tree of life with all the fruit that it bears. So it's very iconic for me. And then we had some really nice times with family. But after Christmas, I started reflecting on the experience, and I thought, what am I feeling? There's something not complete about this. And then I realized that it had to do with how the Gospels tell this story of the birth of Jesus. And though what I experienced was good, I really appreciated it. It wasn't the experience of the birth of Jesus, which is so cosmological and so compelling. And what I realized, because I'm very concerned that here we have 10 years till 2030 to really do a massive mobilization to keep our planet from becoming unlivable. And certainly facing the extinction of human life as well as the life of many species. So just trying to face this, and a connection happened in my mind between the way the birth story is told in the Gospels and the urgency and immediacy of this huge challenge before humanity today. When I saw that connection, there was just this thing that happened right in my gut, and I wanted to start writing. So that's how I decided to write the book.
Good. Well, what do you mean when you say that the Christmas story and the birth story exist in two different worldviews, worldviews largely adversarial to one another?
Yes, that was part of the breakthrough. When I was writing the blogs, Jerry, I don't know to what extent you recall them, though I know you read them and you used them on your website. I was still largely thinking of the Christmas story and the birth story as a story that could be. That the birth story is as in the Gospels could still kind of radicalize the Christmas story, but what I realized as I got the deep passion to write this book was no, my struggle over the years, even when I was pastoring churches, was that I was trying to put these two stories into the current world dominant worldview, and it doesn't work. They weren't. They didn't originate that way. They originated in two different worldviews. Well, we can give those worldviews different names, but one is to use the language that I've developed, like in the Eden for the 21st Century trilogy that you mentioned earlier, one Earth and multi-Earth, a worldview that requires more than one planet to sustain all of the structures and habits and ways of living, or a one Earth worldview which seeks to live within the parameters and generous limits of our planet. So the Christmas story, turns out, is in the multi-Earth worldview. I hadn't seen that clearly before. And the birth story is very clearly in this creation-centered one-Earth worldview. The Christmas story is very much in a superpower kind of worldview of domination, and is not founded in creation. Well, this is even verified further when you look at the dates of these, how these stories originated. See, the Christmas story didn't happen in the first Christ Mass, which is, I guess one could say, the earliest beginning of the Christmas story, though that story has evolved in its own way that goes well beyond the parameters of the book that I've written. But the Christmas Mass, the Christ Mass, the first one was celebrated in 336 of the Common Era. So that's over 340 years after when Jesus was born in 6 B.C. or before the Common Era. When the whole story of Jesus was in the worldview of a creation-centered countering the Roman Empire, how to live in resistance to an alternative to the empire of Rome, which was the superpower of its time. The Christmas story, in fact, was born in the imperial church after Constantine became the emperor and made Christianity the favored religion of the empire. That's when the first Christ Mass happened. So it was born in that worldview, which was blessed by the empire. So once I realized those two different origins of the story and the way those stories get lived out, it was enormously helpful to my thinking. And because, of course, the multi-Earth story is often very adversarial to the one-Earth story, and the one-Earth story lives in resistance to the multi-Earth story. So that then become the dynamics of this book, The Liberating Birth of Jesus, and you know how this birth story is a story that can reverse our planet's perils.
Yes, indeed, that subtitle connects the birth story to the perils of our planet today. Is this stretching, or do you believe it's a solid connection?
Yeah, you know that we do a lot of things where we say, "Oh, this is a story out of some sacred text. How does it apply to today?" For me, in this story, it's almost the reverse. It's like I look at it, and I realize what's happening today, and I think, "Oh my gosh, how did I?" miss that part of what is revealed in the birth story about this connection to creation. I just completely missed that part. So it's not about stretching it to make it apply. It's really about uncovering what is there. And so, yes, I get into that throughout the book as I talk about a new creation, and that really becomes the basis for how the birth story connects with our planet's perils and is able to reverse It really has the energy and the power, if we will put ourselves into that kind of story. We have our lives being shaped by the kind of story that can help us reverse our planet's perils. Well, let's take a break from this for just a moment, Jerry. And I'd like to just say in this break that we, speaking of a creation-centered worldview, one of the things that in One Earth Jubilee Living now that we are urging people to do, and we're taking this as a discipline for ourselves also, is to look at our travel and to offset the carbon we put into the air through travel, whether it's train, car, or airplane, and offset that with a purchase, a donation to the Tree Fund, Jubilee. Tree Fund, Jubilee is now registered with the Trillion Tree Campaign to plant a trillion trees in the next decade, which if we do this, and there's plenty of room on the planet for it, this has all been mapped out by the campaign, if we do this, then we'll be able to reduce, through the miracle of photosynthesis, reduce the carbon in the air to a livable and sustainable level. So we're really encouraging our listeners here to calculate the amount of carbon dioxide you put into the air in your travel, and we'll give you in our show notes here for this episode a link where you can calculate it, and then you can donate that amount to the Jubilee Tree Fund, and it'll become part of a tree planting project in either San Cristobal, Mexico, San Mateo, Mexico, or San Diego, California. There are tree planting emphases in all those places, and we'll collaborate with them and help you counter the carbon you put into the air by how you can take it out of the air. Well, I think that's an important action for us to take, Jerry, so we can return to the conversation about my book now.
Indeed. Well, Matthew opens his gospel with a genealogy, and you give a lot of attention to it, though it seems boring to the casual reader of the gospel. Why do you write pages and pages about Matthew's genealogy?
It's kind of humorous to me, really, because when you look at those opening verses, you say, "Oh, I can skip over this. When do we get to the part about Jesus being born?" Well. Here again, it was some years ago now, but I began to realize that genealogy is somehow, in Matthew's mind, serving his purposes. So how do we get into Matthew's mind? Because in the mind of the casual reader of the Gospel of Matthew, it isn't our way of thinking. It's like, we don't need all this information. You know, if I'm going to tell you a little bit about my life, I don't have to spend a big introductory part of it telling you about my family tree. Well, it happens if you look carefully at Matthew. It's so important what he's doing here, because he has figured out a way to use selective genealogy to introduce a very radical kind of message and a very special kind of birth story that is revolutionary. So he opens it, first of all, the very first verses, and right away he echoes the book of Genesis. You know, it's like, oh, he's talking about creation. And it's our first clue that Matthew thinks of the birth of Jesus as a new creation. This is like the world, you know, like a new origin story. It's like, okay, if our origin story is in the creation story of Genesis and Eden, of course there are many origin stories in the world, and Matthew is aware that, well, we can have a different origin story, picking up on a new kind of humanity and a new kind of creation that happens if we will get into the worldview that is represented in the life of Jesus. instead of the worldview that is represented by the Empire of Rome. So, and of course, when Matthew is writing, he is writing around 85, 90 years, well, yeah, after the birth of Jesus, and he's writing after the writings of the Apostle Paul and the epistles. He's writing after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD by Rome. So this is that was an incredibly painful experience with a complete loss of the Jewish identity there in the temple and all. Well, at this point is where Matthew introduces what he calls a gospel, which in itself was a political word because the only time that the language of gospel was really used was to refer to the stories of military victories. And so gospel was about, oh, the Roman army has won such and such a victory. So it was an imperial word, and it was an imperial story of success. Well, Matthew and Mark and Luke all get treated as gospels. Mark is the only one who actually claims the word for himself, but Matthew and Luke are given that language very quickly by the early readers, and they are giving this good news of a whole different kind of victory that is nonviolent, and that is the creation of something alternative to empire. And the genealogy then points us out. Genesis has five or six different genealogies in it, and here Matthew uses one, and it's clearly selective because it isn't a comprehensive genealogy, and there are four women in it. Now, this is a real anomaly for genealogies of that time. So it starts saying, okay, so what's Matthew doing here? He's clearly got something up his sleeve. What? Let's figure this all out. So I spend all those pages and pages that you talk about writing about the different women. You know, and the women aren't sort of the heroines of what we call the Old Testament. They are Tamar, they are Rahab, Ruth, who, though she has a kind of romantic sense about her, is also a pretty radical woman, as I point out in the book. And and Bathsheba. So those are the four women. Well, each of these women is a stumbling block in the story. Either they are foreign, non-Jewish women, or they're closely allied with foreign people. And so these are stumbling blocks, but they become stepping stones to a new consciousness. So it's a powerful genealogy, and the overall point of it is that Matthew selectively uses this genealogy to introduce what he regards as a scandalous story of Joseph and Mary coming together to give birth to a child who is clearly within the worldview that counters the imperial way and is giving people an alternative to it. And if we don't see that, we miss completely understanding why Matthew wrote this. So that's how I think about the genealogy, Jerry. I hope that makes sense.
Oh, that's challenging indeed, Lee. Well, you also regard the dreams in the birth story to have a lot of significance. Why is that?
Yeah, dreams. Wow, it seems to me that there are people certainly who pay attention to dreams in our world today. But for many sort of mainstream thinking, we wouldn't make mainstream decisions by and large based on dreams. And yet Joseph does, and the Magi do. And so here we have Joseph who decides to marry Mary. He decides to move his family to Egypt to escape Herod. He decides when they can come back from Egypt, when it's safe again. And then he decides where to actually live, to take up residence where his family can feel safe. Now, all of those happen by dreams. And The Magi, who had committed to Herod to return and tell him what they found in Bethlehem, in fact, by a dream are told to go another way, and so they disobey King Herod and go back by a different way, all in protection of the new child. Well, what's going on here is that these dreams are, you know, that they're not part of the conscious mind. They're part of the unconscious mind. So dreams are a way of enlarging our knowledge if we pay attention to what our unconscious knows. Our conscious mind simply can't assimilate all that it needs for good decision making. So we get into the deeper dimensions of our souls, our psyches is would be the scientific word, but souls is an equivalent good word that has a more spiritual connotation. And if we get into the depth of our souls, it's full of information and archetypal symbolism. The language of the soul is the language of symbols and imagination. The language of the rational mind, of course, is more the language of logic and words and reason. So it's very important for wholeness in a world where we're going to resist, reverse the perils of the planet, to be tuned into the knowledge of our souls. And the soul has a capacity to connect with the sacred in a way that the rational and logical mind does not. So it's just essential to connect with a worldview in which we sense and love the sacred in all things and are loved by it. That's how we're going to reverse the perils of the planet. If we don't have that ability, that capacity to see the sacred in all things, then we can continue to do the extractive kind of destructive economy that we currently use to sustain multi-earth living. So the dreams are a very important part of that, and Joseph and the Magi in this story show us how revolutionary they can be. And of course, Matthew's worldview is right there. So now he's given us at least two different compelling ways to think about a revolutionary story. One is a selective genealogy, and the other is the dreams of our unconscious.
Well, Lee, you also refer to cosmology as an important element of transformation in the birth story. How is this so?
Yes, so cosmology is is a rapidly evolving area of study and knowledge today. And, you know, just to think about it in this way, if you think of the name Carl Sagan or the name Stephen Hawking or the name Thomas Berry, these are people who right away are cosmologists. They think about reality in a way that is not limited to how the planet is shaped. They recognize that there are forces at work beyond the shakers and movers of our planet, the powers of our planet. Now, that's very important because when we think only in terms of history, and there's lots to be learned from history, so nothing I say here should be understood as a negative view on the importance of history. But if we limit ourselves to the historical, we limit ourselves also to the powers and principalities that enforce the rules of what's happening on the planet. And those are very oppressive to some, even as they are empowering to others. And so in the superpower world of today, with the way the corporations and military enterprises and financial institutions of the world and the imperial church too, all of these have a way of shaping how we're supposed to live, and who's in and who's out, and what we have to do to succeed. Cosmology it puts it all in a different context. Thomas Berry, the priest and cosmologist, was known to have said on a number of occasions that the cosmos is the only story without a context. It is its own context. The cosmos gives context to the Earth story, to anything that's happening on Earth. So Matthew gets this. I mean, anyone living in the One Earth worldview gets this, that we can't be limited only to history, that if we do that, we get discouraged and depressed. We need to open ourselves to the incredible possibilities of the cosmos. And the cosmos is part science, and it's part art, and it's part religious, because it seeks to give meaning. So a cosmologist is seeking always to give meaning out of the scientific knowledge to events here on the planet. So Matthew is clearly doing that. I mean, the stories of, you know, angels, there's the star, there's the continual breaking in to the events that we would call the events of history by something that is beyond history. And so, you know, Mary's astonished when an angel appears to her, as is Zechariah. And Elizabeth is astonished when a spirit other than the spirit of empire starts speaking through her. And so this is then the Holy Spirit, a spirit of wholeness, a spirit of the sacred, a spirit of the One Earth worldview. All of this is part of the cosmology, and that's why it's so important as another element in a story of revolution that Matthew gives us in the story of the birth of Jesus, able to reverse the perils of the planet.
Indeed. Well, the book concludes with actions to take to make the birth story real in our lives. What are some of those actions?
Yes. I suppose if people are looking for, well, you know, to do things that they maybe aren't doing right now, or a specific list of today I have to do this and tomorrow I have to do that kind of action. The actions there are come out of a deeper place where we really have to work with our own souls as well as to act externally. So the actions, for example, are to really stand with people who are thought of as enemies. It's one of the difficult things that in the multi-earth worldview, there are always those who are in and those who are out. There are always enemies and those who aren't. And when we think in the One Earth worldview of bringing the unity to things, we have to always become aware in our own mind of who we are, who we treat as the other, who we treat as less important, and to learn to stand with that part in ourselves, to stand with that part of that part of ourselves that we see in the lives of others. So that's one example. And so you see when you think about that, oh yes, there's things I have to, that I can do. It's an ongoing task. It's not that you don't already know that, but in the next 10 years, we have to mobilize on this to ways we just haven't so far to reverse the planet's perils, to honor the birth of Jesus' story. If we take another one is patriarchy, and Tamar is the one who really exposes the abuses of patriarchy. We really, really can no longer sustain patriarchy in the next 10 years. We have to get beyond it into a far more holistic way of understanding leadership. We have to really stand with women and all others who are feeling oppressed in a whole variety of ways by men who are scared to death that they're losing their power. And of course, that's exactly what needs to happen. It's the spiritual conversion that needs to happen, and it's what Matthew saw in his genealogy that needed to happen. So this story is a way of, the birth story of Jesus is a way of urging us every day to get out of patriarchy and beyond it. And of course that includes my own struggle with making certain assumptions because in our society it works for me because I'm a man. And then there's a list of, I think, 10 or 11 things. One is panentheism, very important to recognize that God is in all things, that they're sacred in everything, and how for me to work with that. I can see sacred in lots of things, but some things aren't so pretty. So there's a huge struggle. How do we find the sacred in the ugly? How do we find the sacred in the suffering? So those are the kinds of actions that are part of reversing our planet's perils and of living in a one-earth way, as I understand it. So that's kind of a summary of the book, Jerry, right, through the questions you've asked and through the responses. And I hope people will buy it. It's going to be available November 1. It'll be available on Amazon, but of course, Amazon is such a behemoth. Is that how they say the word? This enormous thing. I'm hoping that I'm working on this right now to get it listed also at Powell's bookstore. So that gives us a good independent source to buy the book. And I hope also to be able to get it listed with Barnes and Noble. They have certain requirements that I'll try to meet in the next couple of weeks. So, but by November 1st, you'll be able to get the book, and I hope you'll be able to use it in study groups and as gifts for this season and for your own reflection as well.
Well, thank you so much, Lee, for introducing us to your new book, The Liberating Birth of Jesus, A Birth Story Able to Reverse Our Planet's Perils. In future episodes, we'll talk with Brian Beavers about farmers markets and with Ruth Ann Angus of Yes, We Can Peacemakers. Have you heard our recent episodes? In June, we heard from Carrie Radloff, Sierra Club activist in Iowa. In July, Michael Patrick White Eagle O'Connor, Native American artist and earth activist. In August, Lori Payer, leader of Strong Women of the Four Directions. In September, we talked with George Gastel, who was served on his school board and city council and urges us to make an impact for good through our local governments. In October, Margaret Bullitt Jonas, missioner for Creation Care, who asks, are faith communities mobilizing for the climate emergency? Well, please do listen. You're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes. Also subscribe to my Simpler Living Daily Nudge to get quick reminders of our blogs, our podcast episodes, and other intriguing happenings and events, such as Non-Conform Freely Celebrations, ways to honor rites of passage and holidays without consumerism. Please tell us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Well, time to wrap up this episode. You can subscribe to this podcast under the names The Common Good Podcast and Simple Living Works at your favorite podcast service. Urge your friends to do the same. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of Jubilee One Earth Economics, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live. Do not conform to the world. Be certain that better's not more. Contentment will transform your need. Awakening what God has in store. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.